Actually sharp, pointed, and insightful. This is Stacy on the Right on American Family Radio and Urban Family Talk.
We just brought a new White House counsel today who just started, who's going to be fabulous. The president announced his pick for attorney general, who will be quite good as well. And right now in the White House, we have a lot of good people who are just working along, and the president will make the right choice for chief of staff when he's ready.
If you hire an attorney, you're hiring an attorney to make sure it's done legally in the process. So, and if you're going to try to impeach a president over a campaign finance problem, campaign finance problems are usually fines, which a number of members have. I wonder how they felt about whether they should stay in their job.
If the document that the judge was given was paid for by a political party and the opposing candidate, and it was never verified, and it's not verified to this day, what happens to those who submit the document to the court? If they're not punished, you're going to reinforce doing this in the future.
When politics weren't involved and national security and border security were on their minds, they did the right thing, and we hope they'll do the right thing here. The Democrats have a central question in front of them, Bill. Do they want to keep the government open, or do they want to keep the borders open?
And now, Stacy Washington.
Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being here today. We are going to have a jam-packed show today. We have Catherine Davis. She's the founder and president of the Restoration Project. She's coming on today, and she'll be joining us to discuss her work on the Restoration Project and what that means to Americans and people that are affected by mental illness and dealing with that kind of situation. And we're also going to talk about this big fight between the president and Pelosi and Schumer about the wall. The president actually has a way of funding the wall and so many other things through the military. So there is money there. There's $1.6 billion there. And the Democrats aren't budging. That was what the big fight was about. And that is going to be a part of what the president has to maneuver around during the lame duck and going forward, making plans for what he sees as happening in the next 2 years of his presidency. The president has a job to do. He has made a commitment about the wall and about the funding of the wall, and he's made a commitment to get it finished. Now, a lot of work has already been done. We've covered that here on the program, and we've talked a lot about how the president, through using the military, especially those troops that are deployed now and some of the funding that he's been able to get some of that wall done. But this is not one long, continuous wall. It's a combination of wall, fencing, et cetera. So we're going to talk about the Democrats refusing to fund that, and so on. And then we're going to get into your calls, 866-963-2037, 866-963-2037. And also, the founder or CEO, Google CEO, not the founder, but CEO, Sundar Pichai, he claims he's leading the company without any bias. Now, I know for some of us, that sounds believable possibly, but I'm not so sure, because there is a study out. We've actually had two guests on the program talking about their documentary, The Creepy Line, where they've kind of shown definitively that Google has been able to sway about 2.6 million votes to Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. And this was not, this isn't biased, because one of the people, the one we had on just recently, Dr. Epstein, he's actually a Clinton voter. He believes in liberalism, and he's a part of that movement. But through his work on the Creepy Line documentary and the research that they did, they've been able to find out that this is a danger to the representative republic that we have here in America, because we're talking about taking the will of the voters and subverting it and having a very small number of people in charge of that. So we don't want that. We definitely, we don't have time for it. We don't have space for it. We don't have room for it. And what we're going to do is we're going to continue to look at it, and we'll talk a little bit about what the testimony meant. When you think about a CEO of a company coming before Congress to talk about data collection and so many other things that Google does, the way that they use their developers and other companies, they all work together to collect data on Americans. One statistic that I saw recently is 1,400 times in one day, one single person was tracked using their cell phone and all of their searching history on web surfing and on everything they're doing online, connected with their phone, using that to pinpoint this person's location 1,400 times in one day. That should be something that we're all concerned about. So we'll get into that. Right now, I want to talk about the Daily Confession. And what we have going on today for Daily Confession is that we are heirs and not slaves with Christ. So it takes us back to the story of Abraham and Sarah in the Bible. And so Abraham and Sarah were old and on in the years, and they had the promise from God. God actually promised them that they would birth a nation between the two of them. But when they made that, when God made that promise to them, they actually were pretty on in the years. And then instead of, as we humans like, when we pray for something, God gives it to us immediately. That's what we're looking for. Instead of that, we had the time progressing and a number of years going on beyond where they actually thought they would have a child after hearing this truth from God, this, you're going to birth a nation. And so Sarah took it into her own hands. She decided, I'll help God along. I'll move this situation. And so she asked her servant, a slave that they had in their household, to come together with her husband and give the two of them a child. She felt that this was the only way that it could happen. And Hagar is the name of the slave. And so Hagar and Abram, this is his name before God changed his name, they have this son, and his name's Ishmael. And this is all in Genesis. They're going through this situation that now Sarah has taken things in her own hands, and she's moved ahead of what God's will was. So, of course, you know, the child born by the slave handmaiden servant becomes a thorn in her side and becomes something of a reminder that God promised her something and she couldn't wait for it. And now look what she's wrought for herself. So moving ahead, then God actually moves in his own timing to bless Abraham and Sarah with a child. And when that child is born, they call him Isaac, and he is just the joy of their lives. So the other little boy, the older boy, Ishmael, is 11, and he is actually mocking and making fun of the new little one. And so Sarah says, you got to get out. She sends Hagar out into the desert with her son Ishmael, and Abraham gives them a loaf of bread and a skin of water. Now, this is a pretty devastating kind of story here, where you literally have this, it's the desert, a woman, a young child, that's it, bread and water. But God cares for them while they're in the desert and takes care of her and hears her cry. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, you've got Abraham and Sarah moving forward into what God has for them. But there's a allegory there in that story, in that Hagar represents the works that we engage in as human beings, as people, where we are engaged in works and we're trying to earn our way into things. Because Hagar was a slave and she didn't have a natural place in the family. As long as she was doing the things that she was ordered to do, then she could say, look, I've earned my keep, I've earned my food, I've earned my right to be in the household because I've done what you've asked me to do. And that is what we Christians sometimes get caught up in, where we are saying to ourselves, I'm in Bible study, I'm serving at church, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, which all of that is excellent and we should do it. But when we hold it up as a reason why we should have salvation or a reason why we should feel good about ourselves as Christians, that's us filthy rags, and God doesn't have any place for that, because there's only one reason for us to be admitted to the kingdom, and that is our trust in Jesus Christ. We trust him, we come to know him as our Savior, and that is what redeems us and makes us ready. When we do that, we become co-heirs with him, and we are family, as we saw with Sarah, who didn't have to really do anything. She didn't have to justify her being there in the home because she was family, and that was her position. Her position was the wife and someone who belonged in that household, not having to do anything to justify or to maintain her presence there by saying, look, I've done this, I've done that. She'd gone all of those years being married to Abraham without them ever having any children. So she didn't have anything that she had to do. So the comparison for us is to say to ourselves, am I doing this for God's glory? Am I serving in this capacity? Am I studying the word? Am I whatever it is that we're doing, are we doing that so that we can draw closer to God and experience more of him and have a closer relationship with him and glorify him because we are co-heirs with Christ and we belong? Or are we still hearing the mocking voice, the kind of, you need to do this, this, and this. You have to do this, this, and this. You have to prove that you're saved. You have to prove that you're here or there or wherever you might be placed. You have to prove that you have a reason to be there in the kingdom because you have to earn your way through. We can't earn our way into God's favor. We can't do anything except accept Jesus Christ and then walk with him, being obedient to what he has for us to do. So when we were talking, we actually discussed some of this in a Bible study recently, and we were talking about it. And one of the points that was being made by a number of the women in the room was that we definitely fall into this when we hear, well, you're not doing enough. Or maybe we're judging others, maybe our husband or our kids, you're not doing enough. You're supposed to be here in your walk, or you're supposed to be participating in this and that. There's nothing wrong with encouraging, inviting, asking people to go to church, praying, etc. But we can't say that one person is in one position or place on their walk with God and that they should be in another based on our observations. A friend of mine said that she felt like the reason why she spent so much more time in the Word in comparison to what she observed her husband doing, and we, none of us are with our husbands 24 hours a day, so we don't know when they spend time in the Word. We don't know when they pray. We don't know what they're doing. It's not our job to police them. But she said the Lord convicted her in saying, you actually need more time because it takes longer for you to learn than it does for him. And that was a lesson for her that when she shared, we all kind of smiled and laughed, because all wives have a tendency to say, we should do X for Bible study. We should do that to try to kind of take over the leadership and the head of the home in directing what should be done with our Christian walk. And that's not what God has for us. So I encourage you to, first, we have to know that we are heirs with Christ when we accept him into our hearts, repent of our sins, and become a part of the kingdom of God. And then after that, we are going to study the word. We are going to walk with him. We are going to learn and grow. But we're not going to do it because we're trying to prove to God that we belong, but because we want that closer relationship. The only thing we have to do to come into being co-heirs with Christ is to accept him and to walk with him after that. So that's the daily encouragement. And so also, urbanfamilytalk.com, American Family Radio can be found at afr.net. We are going to be having our guest when we get back. It's Catherine Davis, founder and president of the Restoration Project. And we're going to be talking later on in the program more. We're going to get into what I expected it to be not the friendliest of meetings when the president joined together with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And clearly, it wasn't. It sounds as if they were at daggers and loggerheads with each other. But I still think the president's going to be able to pull something off. And also, Leader McConnell has announced that they're going to move forward with voting on the First Step Act. And so there's a lot of commotion going on in the background about that. Some people support it. Some people don't. We will discuss all of that and more right here on Stacey on the Right. We get back.
Are you still stuck on the healthcare roller coaster? Still paying those high premiums? And strapped into huge deductibles? Not knowing what's around the next turn? Well, then let me tell you about a sound, sensible healthcare choice that really is affordable. It's MediShare, the healthcare sharing solution people like you have been trusting in for more than 25 years. MediShare members report saving around $500 a month on their healthcare costs, and they never pay for things they don't believe in. Time to say goodbye to that healthcare roller coaster and say hello to MediShare.
Call *345 to find out how much you can save on your healthcare. MediShare. Call *345. Message and data rates may apply. That's *345.
Hi, I'm Crawford LaRich with a Legacy Moment. Both of our sons excelled in athletics in high school. However, Brian was a better basketball player than he was a football player. So Karen and I were a little bit concerned when Brian tried out for the football team. Not because he didn't have the ability, but because the team was very good. He tried out for the team, went to the practices, the various cuts were made, and each time his name was still on the list. He was still being considered to make the team. We knew the final cut was coming up, and I was anxious that day. He came home from practice, smiled, and said, "Hey, Dad, I made the team." It's a good feeling to be chosen, isn't it? You know, for years, I've often placed a verse under my signature. I guess you could say it's my life verse. It's John chapter 15, verse 16. Listen to these sweet, wonderful words from Jesus. "You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you." That opening line really grabs my attention. I love the comfort and security of these words. "You did not choose me, but I chose you and I appointed you that you should go and bear fruit." We're not an afterthought in the mind of God. He selected us and gave us an assignment, something to do. Here's what I want you to remember today. You didn't even have to try out for God's team. That's amazing. He sent His Spirit to rule you and call you. You've not only made the team, but God wants you to be a productive member of the team. He's given you a place of meaning and a place to make a contribution. Now let's get in the game and make a difference.
More information about the ministry of Crawford LaRich can be found online at livingalegacy.org. Join Crawford tomorrow for another Legacy Moment.
You can watch a live stream of the show on Facebook or YouTube at Stacy on the Right. Now, back to the show on American Family Radio and Urban Family Talk.
Welcome back to the program. It's my pleasure to welcome Catherine Davis, founder and president of the Restoration Project. Thank you, Catherine, for joining the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about the Restoration Project. Tell the listeners what it is exactly.
The Restoration Project is a pro-life, pro-family, pro-education organization that right now is dedicated to life. Because if we don't have life, we certainly don't have a family if there is no education. So right now I have spent time educating about abortion and its impact in the Black community with an eye toward pointing us back towards family. You know, family used to be a big deal in the Black community. And getting us back on track with family so that we can then begin to focus and improve our education system.
So let's talk a little bit about a story that was just in the news. It's still kind of roiling through the different parts of the pro-life movement, which is that we had Justice Kavanaugh and the head justice over the Supreme Court, Justice Roberts, both decide that they didn't want to hear a case or a couple of cases that had to do with defunding Planned Parenthood in states like Kansas and Louisiana. And so I myself have been very disappointed about Justice Kavanaugh and you know, Chief Justice Roberts deciding that they didn't want to have anything to do with the cases just because Planned Parenthood was tangentially involved. It really has to do with whether or not Medicaid can make a decision about what providers they will or will not pay to, much less about Planned Parenthood specifically. But they declined to hear the case because I guess it's so close to Judge Kavanaugh actually becoming a justice on the Supreme Court and the contentious nature of his confirmation hearings, especially around the pro-life issue. How do we move past this now that we see that he's going to kind of maybe veer away from that, as a movement, as a group of people who want to see less funding of Planned Parenthood?
You know, that's a very good question that I'm not sure I really have an answer to, because I was stunned to read that, you know, coming out the gate already he positioning himself in not a good place to abide by the Constitution. I mean, the whole hearing was about whether or not he was going to make decisions based on what the Constitution actually says, rather than the fiction that they've created. And he backed away from that coming out of the gate. So I'm not sure of even how to take that. But when we raise the question of Planned Parenthood is very heavily financed, a large part of it from taxpayers' pockets. Mm-hmm. And so they have a network that they employ to make sure that their agenda is remaining intact. And that's something that needs to change. They should no longer be able to get, they should have never gotten it in the first place, but they should no longer be able to get taxpayer money to do anything, actually.
I know, I was going to agree with you. It's not just the $558 million. The reason that they appealed they sued these states about the defunding at the state level is because they get much more than the $558 million a year from the Planned Parenthood funding from the federal government. They actually get $1.2 billion, and those are 2015 dollars. I'm sure the 2018 numbers is even higher, for abortion funding through Medicaid reimbursements. And that's what this fight was really about, whether or not Medicaid can defund them. I guess my question for you is, though, you know, Catherine, are you feeling like this is something that portends to the future, that he's actually going to swing to the liberal wing? Or do you think that this particular case is just too close on the heels of his confirmation, and maybe he's just too afraid to dip his toe in?
You know, I am hoping that it's the latter. I'm hoping that he is using this time to get acclimated to the court before he wades in deep on such a heavy issue such as Medicaid funding for a state's ability to decide who they're going to give their Medicaid funding to. I have to hope that. Now, realistically, what it looks like when we look at it is he's signaling he is not as conservative on the life issue as the pro-life community thought. I'm hoping that's not the case, and that there will be more opportunities in the future for him to really, you know, determine where he is on the life issue.
So, yeah, I can see where you would say that. I mean, I'm with you. I'm not willing to write him off just yet, but it is interesting that on this first large case having to do with Planned Parenthood, he would side. But also lost in the conversation is Justice Roberts. Why would he swing to the left liberal wing on an issue like this, when he has traditionally, except for Obamacare, been a solid Republican? He was appointed by a Republican, et cetera. Like, what is going on here?
Well, you know, Justice Roberts let the nation know with Obamacare where he stood on the life issue. I don't know why he voted the way he did on Obamacare, other than to wonder if there was some way that he was being coerced or his arm was being twisted in some way. But again, you know, it's hard to speculate on, are they going to stay there? Are they going to come back to what's actually in the Constitution? What are they going to do? Because the promise was that he was going to follow what the Trump administration appointed him to do. And so the fact that he so quickly ran away, because, you know, Trump is supposed to be, as many think, the most pro-life president we've ever had. And I would have thought he would have taken the opportunity to thank the Trump administration for standing with him through that contentious Kavanaugh, through the contentious hearing. But, I'm puzzled by it. I am absolutely puzzled by both gentlemen, Justice Roberts and Kavanaugh, because they didn't follow the mandate that I thought they were handed through their appointments to the court. So I'm confused.
Yeah, I am too. I wish that we could get some kind of explanation as to why he did what he did, but I guess we now have to kind of wait it out and, you know, continue to prayerfully, lift him up and hope that he'll be more courageous at the next opportunity. I wanted to turn to some good news for the pro-life movement, which has been, it's not often we have really good news, but new information out of the CDC says that the number of abortions in this country is down significantly over the past couple of years. The numbers for 2015 and 2016 and 2017, per the CDC, have another 300,000 less abortions per year in this country. What do you attribute that to?
I attribute it to many women being better educated, but I have to be careful in what I'm getting ready to say to you right now. There has been a decline overall in the numbers, but not in the Black community. The Black community is increasing or holding steady at about somewhere between 30% to 40% of the abortions are being performed on Black women. So while the overall numbers are decreasing, that's more in the Caucasian community than in the other communities, while organizations like Planned Parenthood are stepping up their targeting of what they say is women of color or colored women, as they would say back in the day. So their targeting has not diminished. In fact, it's increased in communities of color rather than decreasing. But in the Caucasian community, I think they see that the population control effect is taking place, and they realize their numbers are so diminished that they're no longer having enough children to reproduce themselves. And so they are making the quote choice to have their children rather than terminate their lives in abortion.
Well, I'll take it for whatever the driving reason is. I'll take it, because we do need more Americans, and we need more Americans to have families of a little bit larger size instead of one or two children, maybe three or perhaps four children, because we shouldn't be replacing our population through immigration. And I think when we're talking about this, first of all, it is an atrocious thing that because the Black community would be at, 18-19% of the population right now if it weren't for abortion. Right now we see 18-19% of the population is actually Hispanic, and our numbers as Black Americans remain stagnant at about 13.8, and it's traditionally been 12%. So that's a teensy little bump, but nothing when you look at the number of abortions that are being had in the country. And I believe we're throwing away our treasure, you know, and this is for any group of people that are having abortions. We're throwing away our treasure, and God can't bless that. And so we have to turn it around. So let's talk a little bit about the messaging. Your organization, the Restoration Project, you seek to restore a lot of different things for young women, especially those who are in the childbearing years, through them making pro-life choices. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I want to say something here, too, before we move on to, well, it's actually a combination of both. The Black community is being targeted by the abortion industry, and we would be way more than 18% of the population if we weren't engaging in abortion at the level that we are. We are somewhere between 12% and 13% of the population, but we need to recognize that only 3% of us at any given point in time are of childbearing age. So that is a huge disproportionate impact. And now we know that more than 20 million Black children have died in abortion since Roe v. Wade. If you look at the fact that those 20 million, many of those 20 million would have had children themselves, one to two children themselves, let's say they would have had two or three, then we're talking a whole exponentially greater number of African Americans being available in this population. But this, the abortion industry was birthed out of a population control, segregationist, eugenicist mindset. If you go back and you look at what was going on in the 70s, you will see that there was a movement of which Planned Parenthood was a large part and proponent to legalize abortion to control the Black birth rate. And in fact, you have recordings, because, you know, Richard Nixon recorded everything he said in the Oval Office. You have recordings of him saying that he knew what was going to be aborted with the little Black bastard. His words, not mine. And so it was launched in an effort to control our birth rate in particular, but the overall population in general. The fact that Planned Parenthood has consistently waged a war against the Black community through abortion ever since then is a tragedy that has risen to genocidal levels. So now we're no longer just talking about a woman choosing, but we're talking about an organization that daily takes measures to prevent birth in the Black community, which, according to the laws of the United States, is genocide. And that is what is happening with Black women, to the point that Planned Parenthood even tweeted out on Halloween that it's safer for a Black woman to abort her child than to have her child or carry it to term. So they are now pushing an agenda that says Black children are like a disease, and you got to get rid of it. Come to us. We'll help you get rid of it, because lest you die. There's something inherently wrong with that. And there's something inherently wrong with a whole generation of young Black women who believe that abortion is their friend, because that's what they're constantly being fed. And now they're giving them a spirit of fear to say, don't have children because you're going to die. But they're certainly not telling them about the numbers of women that are dying in these abortion centers, which are so squalid, many of them. Most states can't even begin to tell you what condition the insides of those clinics are.
Yeah, and that's why I encourage people to watch the movie Gosnell. We have had a number of Planned Parenthood clinics close, and we've also had a number of private clinics around the country that have had to shut down because of additional scrutiny that they weren't under before, no inspections, et cetera. And they're not safe places. Remember, the Democrats have said for just years and years and years that they want safe, legal, and rare. And abortion in America today is none of those things. And so we've got to have a heavenly mindset about this, that, as you stated, I think one of the most important things that you've said today, Catherine, is that we're aborting the future, and the eugenicists get to laugh and win when we destroy human lives in the womb. Thank you so much for coming on today, Catherine Davis, founder and president of the Restoration Project. I'll share the video that you sent to me in the YouTube and different streams that we have online. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me. God bless.
All right. Talk to you again soon. God bless you. We'll be back with more right after this. We'll be right back.
What does it take to live an uncommon life? Here's former Super Bowl winning coach Tony Dungy with today's uncommon moment.
The night that Leanne Toohey saw Michael Orr cold and alone walking the streets of Memphis, she didn't see God's overarching plan. She didn't know that she and her family would mentor this young man to receive an education and a place in NFL history. All she knew that rainy night was that Michael needed help. When God calls us to act, we get to be a part of His divine intentions. Ephesians says, "We are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works which God prepared in advance for us to do." But these good works, whether it's a call to love, to mentor, or to reach out, are never about us. They're about God.
New York Times best-selling author Tony Dungy, author of the popular Uncommon book series. Discover more at CoachDungy.com. That's CoachDungy.com.
Abraham Hamilton III.
God put us in this world at this time to be salt and light. We don't fool because of the darkness that we're facing. This is not the first time in the world's history that it's gotten dark. God has called you and I to be His ambassadors, even in this dark moment.
Tune in to the Hamilton Quarter, weekdays at 5 p.m. Central on Urban Family Talk.
Holy Spirit speaks to everybody. The problem is most folks don't listen.
Lonnie Poindexter.
If they do listen, they don't take it to heart or they get fearful or whatever. But when you listen and act upon it, wonderful things happen. And because a man of God heard the voice of God and acted upon it, it blesses me today and you as well for listening in.
Lion Chasers, weekday mornings at 10 Central on Urban Family Talk.
I'm Chad Pergram with the Speaker's Lobby. Christmas time is here, and you'll forgive lawmakers, Capitol Hill aides, and congressional journalists for lacking tidings of comfort and joy. They're all too familiar with various phantasms depicting Christmas past, Christmas present, and yes, Christmas future on Capitol Hill. Although it's been said many times, many ways, December can be wretched in Congress. The holidays on Capitol Hill are usually filled with Christmas Eve Day votes on Obamacare, efforts to avert government shutdowns, brawls over spending. New Year's gets ruined too. The Senate began votes on New Year's Day 2013, not long after the ball dropped. This year's Christmas festival involves a potential government shutdown on December 22nd, unless there's a deal on President Trump's border wall. Call that the nightmare before Christmas. With the Speaker's Lobby, Chad Pergram, Fox News.
Welcome back to Stacy on the Right on American Family Radio and Urban Family Talk.
Well, what we have is a difference of understanding about what's happening at the border. You know, the president has been very clear from when he ran for office that he wants to protect America's border and keep this country safe. And now more than ever, when you see the caravan, I know what Lindsey Graham was talking about, you've got thousands of people literally saying, we're just going to storm your border and come into the country. And oh, by the way, we have at least 600 known convicted criminals as part of this caravan. These aren't people seeking asylum, by the way, Sandra. They were offered asylum and jobs in Mexico and turned it down. So let's not talk about asylum. It's whether or not we're going to have rule of law in the country. And by the way, we let a million people a year into our country legally. There's a legal process. There are thousands of people waiting to come to this country the right way. Follow the rules. And the president said, if you want to seek asylum, there's a way to do it. That's not what this is about.
Welcome back to the program. Find more at StacyOnTheRight.com and at StacyOnTheRight on Twitter and Instagram. You are listening to Steve Scalise explaining why border security really is, it's not about preventing asylum. It's not about asylum. None of the things that are being done right now have anything to do with trying to increase or decrease the number of asylum claims. The fact is, most of the claims for asylum are actually bogus. So it's really not about that. There are strict parameters under which a person can claim asylum for any country, but specifically for the U.S., you know, it's not something that's easy to do. Asylum means you're fleeing your home country and going to the next available country, the next country that borders your country, and you're going there because you're literally afraid for your life. And I know it's not... It's not popular, but the fact is, you know, if you're in El Salvador or Guatemala, the next country adjacent to you is not the United States. So it's not about trying to prevent people from making asylum claims. The asylum claims can be made. You can ask for asylum. It doesn't mean you're automatically owed it or that you're going to get it. And the number of people who are confused about this just continues to ramp up, not just here in this country, but in the countries where these people are coming from. According to Customs and Border Protection, and this is their commissioner, Kevin McLeland, he said on Tuesday that the rate at which illegal immigrant family units have entered the U.S. in the last 30 days, they will more than double last year's record number of family units. More than double. And remember, this isn't about actually getting an approval on an asylum claim. All you have to do is get into the country and you're here to stay. There's no one to get you back out. His quote continues, "At the border, we face changing trends in illegal crossings that impact security, exploit our laws, and challenge our resources and personnel. To put this aspect of our mission in context, one day of crossings last Monday, December 3rd, highlights the trends that we are confronting. On that day, we saw the highest number of arrivals at our southwest border in years, 3,029 illegal entries in inadmissible persons arrived at our border last Monday. 3,000 people in one day. 85% of them crossed illegally, which is why the president wants to change the asylum laws to say, if you cross illegally, you can't file for asylum. It basically shuts that spigot off. Because if you're thinking, well, all I have to do is get in the country, then I can file for asylum, I'll go in illegally, and you then do that, then you find out, oh no, I can't actually file a claim for asylum. I've cut my own opportunity to do that off, so now I'm going to be deported. That would be an immediate deterrent, because people who really wanted to file asylum claims would go to a lawful point of entry or to a U.S. consulate where they could apply for asylum in the U.S. Now, CBP apprehended or encountered 1,731 members of family groups and 350 unaccompanied children. What kind of a person do you have to be to send your child unaccompanied to the border of another country? Just go. Just go on up there. Just see if you can get in. So this means that the illegal crossings and inadmissibles last Monday included over 1,100 children in a single day. This snapshot is emblematic of the steady trends that we've seen for many months, increasing crossings overall, with a dramatic surge in a percentage of family units and a growing proportion of Central Americans coming to the border. More broadly, for the last 30 days, we've seen over 2,000 unlawful entries between ports and undocumented arrivals at ports of entry each day. Over 1,070 family members are arriving on a consistent basis. To put this in perspective, will more than double last year's record number of family units at this rate. Now, some people want to say, well, this is, you know, it's lower than other historic peaks. You know, there have been other times where there have been more. And that is true. But McLeland actually, his quote is, "I fundamentally disagree with this assessment. From the experience of our agents and officers on the ground, it is indeed both border security and a humanitarian crisis." So instead of trying to have all these people camped out at the border between the United States and Mexico, we should be helping them in their home countries, which we are already doing. And I think that's the part that is so frustrating to Americans, especially people who are really trying to keep up with the onslaught of information. And that is that we are doing something. America has sent and is sending billions of dollars in aid to countries around the world, to include those south of our border. We are providing aid. We have relief agencies in those countries. We're doing everything we can to bring about a system and a end to the humanitarian crisis. But instead, we're seeing even more people saying, you know, we're just not going to stay here. We're not going to hang around here and handle this in our own home country. So Scalise had a little bit more to say about the security issue at the southern border. It's number four.
The border funding is going to be the big battle in these next 11 days. And the president's negotiating with the Senate right now, House and Senate, Republican and Democrat. The president's laid out very clearly. He wants $5 billion. And it's not just to build the wall. Clearly, that's a big part of it. But it's for all the other technology and supporting things that our Border Patrol agents need. They're attacking, by the way, our Border Patrol agents, some of these people in this caravan, literally attacking Border Patrol agents. We ought to give them the tools to be safe as they protect our border.
We need protection for them as well. So, and that's what he's talking about. The families of Border Patrol agents have every right to expect that their family members, men and women who work for U.S. Customs and Border Enforcement, Border Patrol, all of the different agencies, Homeland Security, any of the agencies that have people, men and women, down at the southern border working, they should not have to worry about their loved ones not being able to come home from work because they've been, you know, smacked over the head with bricks and bottles and rocks, et cetera. They're attacked. They're physically assaulted while doing their duties down on the southern border. We need to put a stop to that. We need better aerial protection. We need better eyes in the sky patrolling those areas. And we need a border, an actual impenetrable fence/wall system that will prevent people from simply crossing over into our country willy-nilly whenever they feel like it. It's unpopular because most people want to appear to be kind-hearted and friendly towards illegal immigrants. And you know, I get it. It's better. Sounds better at parties. Makes you feel like a really great person when people are running around saying, well, the thing is, we do have room in our country for these people, and we should let everyone in, and we shouldn't turn people away. Yeah, okay, nice to say. But operationally, we know that's not the way people feel because they're not actually taking these people into their own homes. You don't see the same people who are talking all this drama about how we need to have more people from other countries in our country accepting them into their extra, you know, spare bedroom. You have a finished basement. You have any extra space in your home at all. Why not fill it up with illegal immigrants? Oh, then you start to hear a different tune. Well, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about our government doing it. Well, yeah. So that means you don't really believe that. People don't really believe this nonsense that they're spouting off about who should and shouldn't be in the country illegally. Now, President Trump has been very clear, and he was actually at this 2018 Project Safe Neighborhoods Conference in Kansas City, Missouri. And there's a quote from his speech there where he started off praising William Barr, who is a former attorney general of the United States, appointed there by President George H.W. Bush. And Barr is actually going to be the replacement for Jeff Sessions as U.S. Attorney General. And of course, he'll have to get through the confirmation process, but he's the person that's been selected by the president. And so, you know, he was talking about this issue at our southern border, but in general, because 40% of the people who are here illegally are visa overstays. And he said American politicians should protect, this is President Trump, should protect American citizens, not criminal aliens. Not one more American life should be stolen because of radical politicians pursuing their open borders agenda. And, you know, this is connected up because during his previous tenure, William Barr actually had an unwavering adherence to the rule of law. He was someone who it was very capable at that point and is still very capable and able to do this job. My hope is that whether it's border security or visa overstays or enforcing our laws on, you know, gun prosecutions, prosecuting straw purchasers, prosecuting people who deal drugs illegally, any of the law enforcement issues that we're facing in this country, my hope is that William Barr, if confirmed, that he would be strictly constitutionally minded and adhere to the laws of the United States and want to prosecute people regardless of their political affiliations or connections. And that's not a statement against Jeff Sessions, who I personally spent a lot of time on the radio when it was during his confirmation process talking about the fact that he wasn't a racist. That was just a horrible smear tactic that was used against then Jeff Sessions. It was used against him because they didn't have anything else they could say because he was an excellent candidate. His recusal, I think, was the straw that broke the camel's back between his relationship with him and the president. And I don't know why he did that, other than Mueller and some others kind of probably wrung, you know, his wrists about doing it and convinced him that it was the right thing to do. And I'm not completely convinced that it was. I actually think it was the wrong thing for him to do, to recuse himself. But he did it. And that was what started him on the path to no longer being the attorney general under this president. And so we're going to see what happens with William Barr. I don't actually have an opinion one way or the other, whether or not he should be the president's pick. It seems like he would have had someone in mind as long as the president has been, over these last months, publicly considering no longer having Jeff Sessions in that role. And there's another quote from the president. He was talking about the ICE officers working with state and local partners. And he used this this speech to this law enforcement group to talk about illegal immigration, to talk about crime prosecutions and the enforcement of the law, and to talk about Project Safe Neighborhoods, which is something that was started by former Attorney General John Ashcroft way back in 2001. And the quote from the president is, "Every day our brave ICE officers are working with the state and local partners to get some of the world's most violent criminals off our streets. We get them out of our country," I'm paraphrasing. "We get them out. Since I took office, ICE agents have arrested over 235,000 aliens with criminal records." Think of that. 235,000, and then you have a lot on the Democrat side. They're saying, "We don't want to respect ICE. We want to get rid of ICE. We're not getting rid of ICE. They're going to be with us. They're heroes." And he talks about how those 235,000 criminal illegal aliens included those charged and convicted of more than 100,000 assaults and more than 4,000 murders. Now, these are statistics that we've been talking about here on the show for quite a while. It's great to hear the president share this information in a speech to law enforcement officials to kind of bring to bear the seriousness of the issue that we're facing here. But there's more to it than that, even. We're talking about the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol and ICE seizing more than 2.8 million pounds of illicit narcotics. They've quadrupled the seizures of fentanyl. And now, of course, there's a new deal between the president and President Xi of China. And he's saying he hopes that we won't have to worry so much about trying to root out illicit fentanyl because of the cooperation of the Chinese government. And I do hope that's true, because that is a part of the narcotics problem that's going on. The opioid epidemic is rooted in that, you know, prescription fentanyl and then other drugs being laced with fentanyl and people don't know it. And so the president went on to talk about removing the vicious poisons, the deadly predators, and depending upon partnerships with local communities. And that kind of points us, you know, obviously the sanctuary cities is something that the president, he still talks about it occasionally, but it's not as big of an issue because the sanctuary cities are still going on. And what's happening is ICE is upping enforcement in areas that have sanctuary status. In a sanctuary city, when they say they'll no longer cooperate with Border Patrol and ICE, then ICE has to do mass arrests, which you heard about the one in New Jersey where they picked up over 100 people. And so what happens? Well, activists say they're arresting good people who haven't done any crimes. Well, they're actually arresting the criminals that they're targeting, plus anyone nearby who is in the country illegally. And it is a direct result of the sanctuary city status, because they don't have anybody to work with to help them pick and choose who they're trying to pick up. This is a huge issue. I'm glad the president is he's so tuned in on it. And we should be praying and uplifting him and the men and women of ICE and those who are tasked with this responsibility, that they would do their jobs well. All right, that's the show. Give onenewsnow.com news and information, and then we'll be right back.